examples like that. I mean, but darkness is really just the key, and it really came out of it really came up because I was getting so much good dark stuff that I couldn't fit it all in Lightspeed, because if Lightspeed has a general focus, I can't really fill it up with all this dark stuff.
So, yeah, and this week's Lightspeed, a tank only fears four things, is it's dark and it's not. It has an ending which could be interpreted as being dark or negative, and I interpreted it actually as being very positive.
Yeah, I think so too.
And, well, that's basically, so I edit both of these, and Jack Kincaid, who had been the host of both, and he really developed the sound and I guess fostered the hosting of the podcast, gave up Lightspeed, where John then asked me to host it, and I'm still editing Nightmare, but I'm hosting Lightspeed. And Jack is hosting Nightmare. But both are generally 99.5% of the time produced by Skyboat Media.
Yeah, I think people would be interested to know that the way it works is that Skyboat Media, which is run by Stefan Rudnicki, who's a Grammy and Audie Award-winning narrator and producer, Skyboat Media gets the narrators, they line them up, they do all the recordings, and then they shuttle off that audio to Jim, and then Jim takes the audio and he cuts out all the ums and ers and all that kind of stuff. And
also the bad takes. I mean, sometimes one sentence can have five takes.
Sure. Yeah.
And I get to choose. I get to choose which one of the five I like the most. It may not be always the last take.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure there's all kinds of magic that goes into it that I have no idea about even.
Yeah, I've got to say it's fun. It's fun. It is a form of theater, especially the way they do it. And they, both Stefan and Gabriel DeCure are masters of dialect and have amazing voices. But they also bring in people like Alex Hyde White, you know, who to me is, you know, if you are of a certain age, as I am, Wilfred Hyde White. Pickering from My Fair Lady, and got the man did well over 90 films. This is his son.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he's a fabulous reader, and he's a Hollywood actor, where Wilfred Hyde White was most definitely British. Can't get First Men in the Moon. He's one of the co-stars of that. A big Wilfred Hyde White fan here, so it's fun editing his son. There was one story, coincident, the writer I had not really heard of that much, by the name of Samuel J. Miller, who had a piece called about the
57 Reasons for the Slate Quarry Suicide.
That's the one. And I had him on the show, coincidentally, because he was producing a queer science fiction reading evening. And he and I had him on the week after I edited his story. And it's this rather strange kind of a thing. And we'll have to do a show and an interview. Now Stefan and Gabriel are coming to New York at the end of this month for the Audie Awards, as well as BEA, the Book Expo, and I'll be doing at least an interview, if not an event, with them. And the they hire different actors sometimes, and sometimes they do the voices themselves. The other approach, a la Clark's World, is they have one narrator, Kate Baker, who's masterful. And then there's my approach for Hour of the Wolf and the reading series, which is I actually dare to have the writers mm-hmm. who obviously cannot perform as well as professional narrators. But there's something, A, it gives me a niche. mm-hmm. And B, I like the writer's voice, since the first person I ever worked for as an editor was Samuel R. Delaney narrating The Star Pit.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the three approaches, but working with Stefan and Gabrielle, and sometimes getting hidden messages, like, you know, the session begins, you hear the door open to the studio, Gabrielle sits down and says, "Hi, Jim." And I melt. Takes away 10 minutes of work right there. It's like, oh, hi, Gabrielle. So.
Yeah, actually, speaking of Gabrielle, you know, the next issue of Lightspeed, the June issue, is the Women Destroy Science Fiction special issue, which we, you know, it's a double issue, and we did a Kickstarter for it to help make it a double issue, and it was very successful. But Gabrielle, given that it's an all-women issue, Gabrielle is the guest producer for that one. So,
And Muir Lafferty is the host instead of me.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
But I'll still mix it.
Yes. But yeah, Gabrielle is super, super excited about it.
Yeah.
I mean, as we all are, but I mean, yeah, she's just super excited about it.
Yeah, but I have to get audio from her, and let me get this approved from you right now.
Mm-hmm.
I always mix in, I keep Jack's voice in there, as you've noticed. Mm-hmm. But don't you think that we should have Gabrielle just do that little light speed at the end?
That's a good idea.
That little sound logo?
Yeah, yeah, no, we should totally do that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, just get her to do that so that it's... and nobody need know that I, the mm-hmm. editor, have different chromosomes.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely thought a lot about the different roles that everyone normally fills, and you know, we figured, okay, well, you know, all of the editorial side is female, and that's really the important thing. And you know, we even extended that a little bit.
And somebody named Christy Yant, I believe, is the editor of those four stories?
Yes, I can't remember at least one of them is a reprint, but Christy Yant is the overall guest editor, and she selected all the original fiction, and then Rachel Swirsky was our guest reprint editor, so she picked all the reprints, and then we had Robin Lupo is one of my assistant editors. She curated a Flash fiction section, which we've never actually published Flash before. This is the first time. But in order to get as many women involved in the issue as possible, we decided to open up the Flash fiction. And so she edited that section. If I recall correctly, of the audio stories we're doing in June, I think half of them are, or let's see, two of them are the original fiction. One of them is one of the Flash stories, and then one of them is one of the reprints. So
yeah, so
I think you're getting a little bit of everyone.
Yeah. So, but to me, that means I've got 10 stories.
Yeah.
To mix, at least.
Right.
Now I only have to edit 6,
mm-hmm.
which is my usual amount. But I'll just be mixing
mm-hmm.
the four that are the Women Destroy Science Fiction.
Right.
And after that, am I wrong in believing that there's going to be Women Destroy Fantasy?
Yes, yes, yes. So as part of the Kickstarter, we reached a couple of stretch goals, and so we unlocked Women Destroy Fantasy and Women Destroy Horror. So those are both coming out in October. And Women Destroy Fantasy is going to be a special issue of Fantasy Magazine, which people may remember... when I took over as publisher of Lightspeed, I took over as publisher of Fantasy Magazine as well. But then I merged Fantasy Magazine into Lightspeed. And so Fantasy isn't really an ongoing magazine at the moment. But for this, we're bringing it back for this one special issue.
Yeah, it's like when I worked at Galaxy Magazine, we also had Worlds of If.
Right.
Folded into Galaxy.
Right. It would be like if, like, a couple years down the line, Galaxy decided to do that one more special issue of If just as a bonus, you know?
Yeah.
So kind of like that. And then The Women Destroy Horror, that's going to be a special issue of Nightmare, as you could probably guess.
Yeah.
So The Women Destroy Fantasy is guest edited by Kat Rambo, who edited Fantasy Magazine for many years. And Women Destroy Horror is guest edited by Ellen Datlow. And so, you know, like the legendary queen of anthologies.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm just like, yeah, I'm going to have, I guess I'm going to have her here, aren't I?
Oh, yeah.
It's been
yeah,
a while definitely. Since she's been here anyway.
Yeah, drag her down to my studio.
No, she's been to this location up in Harlem twice.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, she doesn't care as long as I drive her. You know, that, you know, that'll do.
Yeah.
There's the thing, what's interesting to me, of course, as probably, I dare say, the person who's been doing audio science fiction, I'm not going to say better, but longer than anybody else mm-hmm. in the world.
Yeah.
Given that I started, God help me, I started here in 1967, May 1st, 1967, but I started working as an editor, learning how to edit. I don't think any of my edits actually made it into the final on the Star Pit with Delaney. But I guess it's fair to say that I have been editing science fiction audio for 47 years.
Hmm.
Which is scary when you think I'm 60.
Yeah.
So, maybe a mere 46 years.
Well, yeah, wow, you got to plan something big for the big 5-0 there. It's coming up on you.
Yeah. Assuming Pacifica and WBAI survive.
Yeah.
We shall...
Well, you'll still be editing for Lightspeed and Nightmare, hopefully, you know, even if they don't, so...
Hopefully, yes, and the skill set that you're giving me will also allow for a podcast edition of Hour of the Wolf.
Indeed, yes.
So Hour of the Wolf is going to continue.
Mm-hmm.
But that does bring us to the point of the continued existence mm-hmm. of WBAI, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And we have been chatting here for nigh on 38 minutes. But we... John has made possible a premium for WBAI at one of the most reasonable prices of any premiums that you can get. Which is to say, first tell us about The End Is Nigh.
Okay, well, The End Is Nigh is the first of a series of anthologies I'm co-editing and co-publishing, actually, with Hugh Howey, who wrote the book Wool. And he's a big self-published success story. So the series is called The Apocalypse Triptych. And so it's a series of three anthologies, the first one being The End Is Nigh. And each one focuses on a different mode of the apocalypse. So The End Is Nigh focuses on life before the apocalypse. And then The End Is Now, the second volume, takes place during the apocalypse. And then The End Has Come is the third volume, and that takes place after the apocalypse. So in The End Is Nigh, it's all stuff sort of leading up until the apocalypse. And we have that triptych happening, but then a lot of the authors in the anthology are going to be writing stories for all three books. And they'll sort of have these little mini story triptychs within the overall, anthology triptych.
So there actually will be arcs.
Yeah. Not everyone is continuing it exactly. Like, I know Jake Kerr is writing a story for the second volume, and he's not picking up with those same characters, but it's set in the same world. So some of the authors are going to do stuff like that, and then the other ones are going to skip around a little bit, and, you know, there's going to be certain time jumps in between them, depending on what the authors had in mind and what type of apocalypse they had and whatnot. But I'm really looking forward to seeing where everyone goes with their stories, because I think all of the stories in The End Is Nigh really stand alone very well, but... They, like most good short stories, they leave you with this, like, sense of wanting more. Well, even though they satisfy, they, you know, you want to know, like, what else could happen in this milieu? So I think they all turned out pretty great. And actually, The End Is Nigh features the first new short story by Paolo Bacigalupi in many years, like 5 years or so.
Yeah.
So that was pretty exciting.
Yeah, because he's been concentrating on novels.
Yep.
For the basic reason, one of my favorite questions, and when I used to work for Datlow on Omni Online, one of the earliest online science fiction ventures, Omni Online and then Event Horizon, I was one of her online hosts on Live Chats. Remember Live Chats?
Mm-hmm.
And I alternated with Ed Bryant, and I would ask every time... The difference between writing short fiction and long fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always purposefully vague. You know, so was I talking about the craft or was I talking about the business?
Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, it drove Ellen crazy. And she still chides me on this. And when Ellen Datlow chides you, you have been properly chided. And but what I will eventually do, and by the way, the text of those chats are still available, and they're on ourwolf.com, or at least links to them are, is I'm going to take all of those questions and put them together with different answers. And on the air, I asked Paolo Bacigalupi about, and that was again one of your doings, wasn't it, that I had him at a NIRSSF reading?
Oh, yeah, maybe. Yeah, I was his publicist for a while.
That was it. You were his publicist at that time. I was trying to think what anthology, but in fact it was a novel, his first novel. And now he's, and his answer, and when I asked him, the answer is you cannot make a living on short stories.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple. Other people, you know, if you ask Richard Bowes, he'll talk about the Mosaic novel and Made Up of Parts. But Paolo's answer was really pragmatic one.
Yeah,
so.
He is very pragmatic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I mean, of course, most people, it's true for most people. There's very, very, very few people who ever have done so, but alas. Hopefully, some of these paradigms are changing, and maybe that won't be the case for much longer.
Yeah, well, one person who you publish a lot, Ken Liu, well, he's working on a novel now.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think he turned it in. But he's made quite the name for himself just as a short story writer and translator.
Indeed he has. And I mean, he's actually kind of a perfect case to illustrate Paolo's point, though, because even with as many stories as Ken Liu sells in a single year, it's like, I mean, it's not, you know, he's not making a living. He's not anywhere close to making a living off of it. I mean, he has a full-time job.
On the other hand, he's a big deal lawyer and he writes software.
Yeah.
With his wife.
Yeah, so he did all of that and also wrote a novel or two, you know. I mean,
yeah.
He translated one, you know, and I don't know how he has any time to do anything.
I have no idea. And he's such a nice guy.
He is, yeah. I'm really glad he's up for the Nebula Award again this year, which is next weekend, being presented next weekend. And he thought he wasn't going to be able to go, but, at the last minute here, he realized that he could go because, you know, he thought he had a court date conflict. But turns out he can go. So I'm going to get to see him next weekend for
good.
The Nebulas.
Yeah. Well, say hi for me. I hope to see him at ReaderCon.
Yeah, sure. We'll do.
And actually, I want to corner him at ReaderCon and a couple of other people. And I want to do a specific interview in a room of my own if they don't have a panel for me. And that on translating SF and idiomatic concepts, because there is no such thing as a god or anything like that in Chinese myth or hard science fiction, but the concepts come up, and how do you deal with that? And it's really difficult. And it's really a challenge in and of itself. And he's done it so well. And interestingly, another person who has made, I don't know about making a living, but has made a career only writing short stories, is, again, an Asian writer, Ted Chiang.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Kelly Link's another one, but, few and far between, unfortunately. Yeah, I mean, I'd love it if authors could just stick around and write short fiction forever. Because a lot of people, they would be perfectly happy to stay there and never move on to novels. A lot of authors they move on to novels only by necessity because it's like, well, I really like doing this writing thing, and it seems like I'm getting pretty good at it. But I want to quit my day job that I hate. And
it's not just that; it's getting your name on a book.
Yeah, sure.
Even if it's not about the money.
Yeah.
But just seeing your name on the cover of a book, the publishers are generally not buying collections of short stories unless you already have a novel.
Right, right.
Or their specialty publisher, like, say, PS Publishing or somebody like that. So, oh, by the way, let me tell listeners, we are going to have a movie review from Dan Persons, but we're going to move it more towards the end of the show so we can have an apocalypse or two first. And getting back to the apocalypse, and the end is nigh, the first of the apocalypse triptych, what we have is you have produced. Now, did you produce the audiobook?
Yeah, I produced it in association with Jack Kincaid. Basically, I went out and I recruited all of the narrators for it, and then, you know, I got them to agree to do all the different parts and everything like that, and then once they recorded it, they did all their own editing and that kind of thing, and then it was turned over to Jack, and he did all of the mastering and you know, sort of oversight type of stuff that you might be like, oh, hey, you might want to fix this thing here or that there, you know, quality control type of stuff.
Right.
So that's how, so we sort of collaborated on it together a little bit, but I mean, he did most of the hard stuff.
Yeah, but you did, but you didn't outsource it to Skyboat Media, because Jack is sort of in-house for you, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. You know, we, part of the reason we did it this way is because, you know, the entire project, has been just self-published and just, you know, right, you know, DIY right from the get-go between me and Hugh. And so, you know, we did actually talk to Stefan about it and we thought about doing it that way, but, we ultimately decided, well, if we're doing this whole thing, it's kind of a big experiment, you know? And so we thought, well, we should do the audiobook the same way. You know, we should do it ourselves if we can. And I mean, you know, and I've been an audiobook fan for a long time, as you know, and, you know, I've reviewed audiobooks for a long time. And so I was like, okay, well, I mean, I'm not a professional in that industry, but I think I could probably pull this off because I thought I knew enough good narrators and I knew I trusted Jack. And so, you know, I think we pulled it off. I think it turned out pretty well. I ended up recruiting people from a lot of the podcasts that I know. So like, an ALA does the Strange Horizons podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And then I picked up a bunch of narrators from like Podcastle and so like Rajan Khanna and, Larice White and, Roberto Suarez. I got all of them from Podcastle. I got Ralph Walters, from listening to Pseudopod. And then there's Norm Sherman who does the Jabblecast and also he's the editor of Escape Pod now. So I got a bunch of people like that just that I recruited from various podcasts. And then there's Kate Baker, who you mentioned earlier, who does the Clarksville podcast, and Mer Lafferty. And then there's some other folks in there.
And like Mer was doing Escape Pod, wasn't she?
Mer, yeah, yeah. She used to be the editor of Escape Pod.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And then, yeah, I just have a few other people here and there. You know, there's Lex Wilson. He used to do sort of a pre-podcast thing called Telltale Weekly, which was sort of a it was a precursor to podcasts in a way. And then there's a narrator named Folly Blaine, who she's done a few things here and there. And I'm not sure which podcast exactly, but, I mean, I know she's done a bunch of different things. And so, yeah, but, I mean, I think it ended up pretty good, and I'm happy with it. And actually, the story you're going to run here later is Bring Her to Me by Ben Winters. We actually did kind of a full cast thing with that. I mean, it's not like your normal full cast audio where everyone does a different voice, you know, how you're used to a full cast audio. But it has multiple narrators, so we actually had a different narrator for each section of the story so that, you know, the same person isn't reading the multiple parts. You have a different narrator for each part.
That, you have Kate Baker, Muir Lafferty, and Nia Lay, yeah. Tina Connolly, Raj yeah. Khanna, Lex Wilson, and Jack and Kate.
Yeah, yeah.
If I'm reading the ID3 file correctly.
You are. Yeah, and Tina Connolly is one I forgot to mention earlier, too. She does the Toasted Cake podcast. So, yeah, and then, you know, that's one of the cool things about this, I think, too, is that it, by doing it this way, we kind of made the audiobook in a way a lot like an anthology in terms of like the audiobook can do for the narrators what an anthology does for the authors in the sense that it sort of gives you exposure to a larger audience because people may tune in for one thing, but then they discover that they like this other thing.
Yeah.
Right. So anybody who bought the anthology because they like Hugh or they like, you know, my anthologies, whatever, or they just want to, you know, they just want to see a Palo Bacigalupi story, you know, maybe they'll discover some of these narrators that they never had heard before, and maybe they'll go check out their stuff. So,
right.
It's kind of like, you know, has that nice feedback to it.
Now, if somebody were to go online to a place like audible.com and buy the audiobook, of the end is nigh. Mm-hmm. That will cost them a nickel shy of $25, right?
Right.
But if one was willing to donate $50 to WBAI, we would make you a free gift of it. So, on the one hand, yeah, it sounds like double the money. Well, it is. But on the other hand, the point is that you're donating $50 to WBAI, and John Joseph Adams has made a donation. And in the name of WBAI, we thank you by gifting you a copy of this anthology, of this audiobook of the anthology. And the way that you do that is you call the telephone number 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, and pledge $50. And you will not only be helping WBAI in, I mean, how often can we say that it's a time of crisis? I would say we're in slightly less crisis than we were a year ago when we were 4 months behind on the transmitter rent, the transmitter being about $55,000 a month. That's the Empire State Building. You know, it's it's what it costs. The operating costs here in New York and the cost of Pacifica, which is having more and more wars, having appeared in court in Berkeley just yesterday, and who knows how it's going to pan out and how much more that's going to cost us and who's going to come out of it. And we're very proud to say that despite WBAI being in New York City costing more than to operate than any of the other Pacifica stations, we are self-sustaining. We are actually making the money that we spend for the first time probably in a decade. And that can only, now, it's ridiculous. I mean, we just finished a fundraising drive like 2.5 months ago, and here we are now doing another. But this is why we're self-sustaining, and the idea is to wean WBAI from these constant begathons and look for new ways of raising money. This, by the way, another very cool premium that I will mention later, which is that you have the opportunity late next week to go to a Mets-Yankees game with a bunch of WBAI staff and listeners. Now, that's a lot more. I think that's about $105 per person. But this is $50. This is a $50 donation to WBAI listener-sponsored radio in New York City. We have been part of Pacifica Radio since 1960. Pacifica Radio began in 1946, 47, and we can't let it die. We're not. There are many people who I will hear define us as public radio. I don't believe we are. We're a private nonprofit institution out of California. Out of, well, there's this neighborhood in California called Pacifica. People look for deep political reasons why we're called Pacifica. Our founder, Lou Hill, lived in Pacifica, you see. Hey, John, trivia question.
Yes.
What besides Pacifica headquarters, which is now in Berkeley, no longer in Pacifica, what is in Pacifica? Fiction. This is a skiffy trivia question.
I don't know.
Nobody gets this one.
And I yet, don't feel so bad then.
And yet it's mentioned in at least one television program and two movies. Three movies.
I give up.
Starfleet.
Oh.
Starfleet headquarters.
Wow. Eugene Myers will never forgive me for not knowing that.
I think he failed that one. No, he's the one who got it.
Oh, yeah. I would have been shocked if he hadn't gotten it.
Yeah, of all the people I've thrown that one at, and I throw that one out a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm ashamed I didn't know it.
Yes, Mr. E.C. Myers, Mr. Yeah. Nebula, well, no, not Nebula winning.
Norton.
Andre Norton Award winning. Eugene Myers got that one.
He's also my assistant editor on Nightmare.
Why didn't I know that?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Yeah, you...
How strange. Okay, it's funny. I have a totally different view of the magazine than probably anybody else. I listen to the stories in their unedited versions. I have a copy of the story in front of me. What I do is I have a tablet, and I look at the PDF file of the story with the director's marks on it. And then where somebody else is going to listen to the story in 37 minutes or an hour long, I'm going to be spending approximately 8 to 12 hours over several days and let it unfold. And I'm not... And when I'm looking at the print, it's more for proofing. Audio proof, if you know, it's not proof reading, it's proof listening than anything else. And so it's a very, very different approach to fiction. And it's funny that that I don't stop to think about actually who's doing the editing, who's doing the proofreading, stuff like that. It's a totally different approach. I work for you, but the voices I hear are Stefan and Gabrielle.
Right.
So wouldn't and alternately Jack and Cade, who I send stuff to and communicate with. So it's a very different view of fiction, and it's a very interesting one. And Stefan, every time I finish editing something, Stefan will always ask me what I in email what I thought of the story. And it's like, well, you know, I actually have to think about that now because I spent 4 days with it.
Yeah.
You know, and he'll have read it two or three times and then record the thing. So he becomes more intimate with it than anybody except you and the writer.
Right.
And then I guess I come in. So it's a very different view of the world. I didn't realize that Eugene was also that into dark.
Yeah, well, it's funny. When Ellen Datlow was editing the Year's Best Fantasy and Horror, I knew that she had hired him to sort of help her triage some various magazines, just basically to look through them and hunt around and see if anything was even vaguely horror. So sort of unlikely magazines to find horror, like something like Analog, which of course has plenty of science fiction, but isn't necessarily going to have a lot of horror, and you know, doesn't really behoove her to spend her time looking for it, even though it's a professional magazine. It's just not very likely to have horror. So she would shunt magazines like that off to Eugene, and then he would read through them and find things that she should take a look at. And so I knew he had done that for her, and so when I was doing Nightmare, I thought, you know, I'd say, hey, well, maybe he'd be more interested in having a role at this level instead of, that kind of level. So.
Yeah, and that also explains something, because I know that Ellen has actually a very broad definition of horror. And one fantasy writer I know found herself with three honorable mentions from Ellen in the Year's Best. And that writer said, I don't write horror.
Yeah.
To which I said, apparently you do.
Right. Yeah, you know, I mean, when we first launched Nightmare, I just had it as a horror magazine. I didn't even have the dark fantasy as part of the description. But, that just kept happening where I was like, well, I'm not really clear myself where the line is per se, but I don't actually care. You know, it's like as long as it's dark and it achieves this certain feeling, that's all I'm actually concerned about, whether or not it's technically horror or technically dark fantasy or technically something else. You know?
Yeah. If you do start drawing those lines, you're going to start limiting the fiction.
Right. Yeah. And I'm more concerned with finding good stories, and as long as they feel right. for the magazine. That's all that I'm really concerned about with that one.
Yeah. So, again, let me remind listeners, we have only 10 copies to give away, and the way things are here up in Harlem at CCNY, we do not have the phone volunteers on hand. So I do not know when these 10 copies will go. Now, I know that it's 2:02 in the morning over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica radio at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org, but had to do a legal break there, but I don't think that they are flying off the shelves, but I do know that at this low premium price, I mean, we have premiums that are $500, $700, $105, most premiums, $50 is as inexpensive as they come. And we are able to make this available to you. John has donated these. And because there is actually no overhead, what happens is when you pay your pledge, we will send your email address to John. John will send it to whoever does the magic at, I assume, Audible.
Mm-hmm. And there's just a code. I'll send you a code, and you'll get you'll be able to go onto the website, and you'll be able to have it subtract the amount from your cart, so it makes it free.
Yeah, exactly. I see. Okay, that makes sense. Perfect. So mm-hmm. It's a code that so you'd be getting it through the normal process at Audible, but
right.
You're basically getting 100% off.
Correct.
Okay, great. And we have that available for 10 people who will donate $50 to WBAI by calling area code 212-209-2950. Again, 212-209-2950. And it's a really cool premium because it's a good book. I haven't seen the whole thing, but I've actually listened to parts of it. I listened to the Charlie Jane Anders story, which was a hoot. It was the funniest thing. You and I were talking about it yesterday, and I just barely started watching the BBC what they call the real history of science fiction, which I, by the way, challenge. it's the real history of science fiction movies and TV shows, and they do have some writers in there, but they're really just talking about movies and all that. And you know, when they talk about Mary Shelley, they show Boris Karloff.
Yeah.
But then they have Charlie Jane Anders talking, and I saw her face, and that was the point where I had to stop watching it. And then moments later, we were talking about this anthology and her piece. And, I sort of suspected Charlie Jane, she does not mince words. She uses them fully to their full Anglo-Saxon glory.
Yeah.
And Pacifica is gun-shy after the Carlin incident. The Supreme Court says I can do it at this hour, but Pacifica wants to figure out how to survive before they'll take the chance first.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to go back and give Ben Winter's story a chance.
Mm-hmm.
But people really should give this audiobook a try. It's a great introduction to... It's really... to me, it's a whole different idea, the idea of narrators, the idea that there are these people that actually have to edit their own readings. I'm taking great pride in being John's editor, the editor of the podcast for the readings produced at Skyboat Media using professional actors and narrators, which is... In the reading book industry, our former arts director, Richard Harris, and Sharon Maplin left BAI and became Random House Audiobooks.
Oh.
And you didn't refer to narrators. You have readers. The narrator word, how long has that been in use now? About 4 years? 5 years?
Oh, I don't know. Surely longer than that.
Really?
I would think.
Yeah, I've only been hearing it that long before they were readers.
Oh, okay.
And by the way, as host of Lightspeed Magazine podcasts, in my copy, I simply said this story. I don't say this story is narrated for you mm-hmm. by, because narrated for you, and you know, as a verb, it doesn't work. I say it's read for you by.
Right, right.
Gabrielle DeCure. To me, that makes, well, better syntax sound.
Mm-hmm.
I can say your narrator is,
mm-hmm.
but the narrator reads it for you. So I say you're. So it depends on the syntax. But mm-hmm. I never really heard the term that way, used that way. Really? Yeah, I guess it's more than 4 or 5 years. How old is Escape Pod at this point?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. Maybe 10 years old or something?
Yeah, so maybe the term, and in the beginning, I don't think they used the term narrator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure. I guess I never really thought about it. It seems like I've been hearing it since I've been listening to audiobooks, but then that might not be the case.
Yeah, but how long, but the audiobook industry as a really going concern,
mm-hmm.
Really, you know, it started in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, they were very few and far between, or I might have actually gotten into the business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, because I sort of dropped out of the idea of becoming a professional creator of audio drama and audio books, what people now call full cast dramas, which I just say radio drama, right?
Right, right.
And audio drama. And they say, hey, full cast drama featuring umpteen. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, yeah, we call that radio dramas. I've produced about 50.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's a tradition that goes back to the 30s. So it's like, thanks to the internet, really, and the advent of the podcast and the iPod, it's all been rediscovered.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the idea that the narrator is a person who actually has to engineer themselves and then edit themselves, to me, that's a very strange idea.
Yeah. It's all about the DIY thing. You know, it's like if people want to get into it, if they can do it themselves, then they have a shot at breaking in, whereas if you know, you need to go through the traditional way where you have everybody else, you know, contributing to the process, it makes it much harder to get yourself out there. So,
maybe so, but with no offense to a lot of the people out there, there are some people that it's like self-publishing. There are some people maybe that oughtn't be out there.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, yeah, I mean, I've certainly listened to enough podcasts where I'm like, oh, why did they get this guy to do it? He's terrible, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I mean, I guess people think the same thing about authors, you know,
yes.
Reading in the magazine.
Absolutely. But to take it even a step further, I think highly of myself because I learned under some very skilled people. I learned with music on the WBAI Free Music Store, where I was a music editor and a editor of radio drama and readings with people like Baird Searles and Chip Delaney and Tom Dish and all Joanna Russ and all that good stuff. And I have a sense where, in talking about this with Stefan, I listen to something and I may put in an edit where, or add room tone, which is to say silence, but not real silence, because there is no such thing as pure silence. You have to have the sound of the room in which it was recorded. And I and Stefan's people send me room tone.
Mm-hmm.
And when I edit, it's like, you know, Martin Scorsese has Thelma Shoemaker. His movies have her thumbprint.
Mm-hmm.
And the Coen brothers have, I forget the name of their primary editor. But the editor is as important to a movie maker as their cinematographer.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't say that I go that far on the podcasts, but I have my sense of timing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that the narrators necessarily do. And the better ones are unconcerned.
Mm-hmm.
They know they're going to be edited. They know that somebody else, just as they're being directed, at least in the case of Stefan, you hear the director through the headphones. Somebody says, can you give me that line again, only this time let's put a little more stress on such and such. It's a production.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like the way you do it on Lightspeed.
Mm-hmm.
And I will not put, I'm never going to be putting down Kate Baker or any of these people. They do a magnificent job, many of them. But as you say, there are many who don't.
Mm-hmm.
But if listeners, and by listeners, I mean not just WBAI listeners, but people who tune in to Hour of the Wolf in order to get readings, want to hear how many stories in the end is nigh? About 22?
I think 23, yeah.
Yeah, 23. Close enough for radio, as we say.
Mm-hmm.
23 stories, and almost that many, or perhaps even more, readers, narrators, what have you, and stories by great writers with lovely, dark, and sometimes humorously dark themes.
Mm-hmm.
Donate $50 to WBAI, and you will get this audiobook as thanks. And the way you do that is by dialing your telephone, 212-209-2950. I was talking with a person, a professional in radio, and by, when I say professional, I mean the CBS radio network, today, and an older person, we were talking about how you can't go into a store and just buy a radio.
Mm-hmm.
You have a phone, you have this device, that device, maybe there's radio built in to something else you have. And he hadn't thought about that. And I said, well, all these kids, how many people under 25 years old who dial their phones have ever seen a dial in their life?
Yeah.
Outside of Turner Classic Movies.
Right.
212-209-2950 is the phone number to call to pledge. It's probably getting pretty late for you, even on the West Coast, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we have a story that is not that short a story, is it? It's about 37 minutes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it is 38 minutes, 37:53, and it's 2:15 here, and a movie review. So you and I had better actually wrap up.
Yeah.
But I want to thank you, A, for being on the show. It's been a while.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's your
good
first...
Good to be here.
Yeah. And we hope you'll do it again. Hope that you get to New York.
Yeah, that would be great.
And we'll throw an event together.
Mm-hmm.
At the NIRSIF readings. And we want to thank you and Ben Winters for the story that we are about to receive. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And for the copies of the audio book that listeners can get for $50. Or rather, by donating. See, you have to be careful. We're not selling these.
Mm-hmm.
We're giving them away free in exchange for your donation. It's a legal thing.
Right. on the subject of audiobooks, actually, and the apocalypse, my first anthology, Wastelands, actually just came out on audio just this week. And it was produced by our friends at Skyboat Media.
Oh.
So, the more traditional type production, as we were talking about. So, Wasteland just came out. It's got, Harlan Ellison narrates one of the stories. So
wow.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And the aforementioned Alex Hyde-White and Stefan and Gabrielle and a bunch of other great people. Finally out in audio and just came out. So, my next anthology, Dead Man's Hand, the Weird Western one, it comes out on Tuesday, and actually the audiobook also comes out on Tuesday. So,
oh, very good.
So, lots of JJA audio on the way here.
Okay, great. And for more JJA information, people go where on the web?
We'll go to johnjosephadams.com, and I have a little mini site set up for all of my anthologies, so if you go to my website, you can find links to all of those, and including one for the Apocalypse Triptych, where you can find all sorts of information about that, and including free samples and all that kind of thing.
Yeah. So. Okay, well, thanks so much, John.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, and you can keep listening if you like, but in the meantime, I think it's time to listen to some Ben Winters.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye. And again, this is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial radio at 99.5 FM. And our guest has been John Joseph Adams, editor and donor of the audiobook version of his anthology, The End Is Nigh. And we are now going to listen to one of those stories by Ben Winters, read for you by, well, a rotating cast. So here we go. That is, if this computer will be compliant. Sometimes takes a long time. Here it's coming.
Bring Her to Me by Ben H. Winters. Narrated by Kate Baker, Tina Connolly, Rajan Khanna, Jack Kincaid, Mer Lafferty, Anaya Lay, and Lex Wilson.
Before she opens the door, Annabelle takes a moment to prepare herself. She smooths the front of her frock and tucks her hair behind her ears and readies her face, smile, eyes, ready. Hello. Hello, hi. The woman from the center launches right in full force. Oh my goodness, we are really getting down to it now, aren't we? We are really getting down to it now. And Annabelle says, yes, we sure are. And in unison, they close their eyes, tilt their heads backwards, and stand glowing for one half a second before snapping back into conversation. I keep pinching myself, says the stranger at the door. And then she does it. She really pinches herself. It's actually, finally, seriously, really here. Annabelle laughs politely as the woman pauses at last to take a breath, and then to say, my name is Marie St. Clair, by the way. I'm from the center. Ah. This had already been obvious, of course. Annabelle knew the woman was from the center because of the clipboard, the flowers, the sash. But Annabelle keeps her smile in place and nods with enthusiasm. Thank you so much for your service, she says. Oh, says Miss St. Clair, waving away the gratitude with a happy smile. It's my pleasure, my honor, I should say. It's all just so marvelous that we are here to see this day. You and I and all of us, everyone now living. We are the fortunate generation we have heard, and we shall travel through. Marvelous. For a moment after that, Ms. St. Clair just stands at Annabelle's door, beaming, and Annabelle beams back. Because even though this speech of Ms. St. Clair's is made up of the same rote praise words that Annabelle has heard a million times, and despite her wariness of this woman, and despite the desperate secret that has troubled her restless heart for so many years, despite it all, Annabelle Lennon feels just exactly what Miss St. Clair is feeling. They feel it together. They stand there in communal pleasure for a moment, if under mistletoe. Together they stand in the sunlight coming from the corridor window, and in the pleasure of what is, and in honey-toned anticipation of what is to come. The truth is, Annabelle does think it's marvelous, and she does feel fortunate to be here, to be alive and in this world at this moment. On this day, she really does. Behind them, out the corridor window, the city is a mass of black clustered towers, like a group of strangers in overcoats waiting for a train. Anyway, Miss St. Clair says abruptly and with force. She takes out a stylus and holds it over her pad. What I am charged with today, on this penultimate day, is performing a final, final, absolutely final sweep to ensure that everyone has heard. Of course, says Annabelle, and then fears she said it too fast. She renews her smile, takes a breath. Absolutely. We all have heard. Everyone in our home. There are three of you? Yes. Mother, father, child. Yes, child, one child, a teenager. Quiet, Annabelle. Hush. Smile. Great, says Miss St. Clair cheerily. She jots with her stylus. And you all know the protocol. Yes, says Annabelle, and bites back the words, of course. Everybody knows the protocol. Obviously, they know the protocol. Everyone is aware of every detail. For the last 10 years, all has been known. All has been arranged as it has been commanded. They have learned the protocol from the center, learned it from one another, and learned it directly from the source of all truth, loud and clear. But Annabelle just says yes one more time and widens her smile. She is smiling so tight now that her cheeks hurt. She wonders if this Miss St. Clair knows somehow, knows the awful truth of their home, and is waiting to pounce. But the dreaded moment never comes. Instead, the woman just runs down the protocol one last time, and then Annabelle must sign that she has listened and understood. She does. She grips the stylus and she signs. It's all mildly ridiculous because, of course, it will be all gone tomorrow. The clipboard, the corridor, building 170, all the buildings. These two smiling women as they are all standing here now, as corporeal beings in a carpeted hallway. Okay, then. I will see you when we've all gone through, says Miss St. Clair at last. And just for one split second, for half of one half of an instant, Annabelle wonders what would happen if she were to ask. But what if it's all wrong? What if it's all just wrong? What if we're all just nuts? Does it ever occur to you? But of course, Annabelle doesn't say that. Of course, she just smiles some more as the woman from the center slips her clipboard into her satchel and goes. And then Annabelle turns and leans against the door with her eyes shut tight and her cheeks burning hot until she hears her husband's footsteps coming down the stairs.
Goodness, no, by the way. The answer is no. It never occurs to Marie St. Clair of the Answer Center that it's all a mistake, all just a terrible mistake. Such a thought would never appear in her mind. She is committed and enthusiastic beyond question to the plan, as she has been since the day she was born. Her head is filled with passionate belief that it is right, that it is right, that all of it is just exactly right. She is not unique in this. Most people feel this way. All people, officially. Ms. St. Clair has been doing this for 7 years, since the Answer Center was established. It's really 9 Answer Centers, one in each building cluster, all reporting to the main center. Marie St. Clair has a chart affixed to the wall in her office, and another up in her rooms in Building 49. Sometimes, at night, before falling asleep, she traces the organizational lines with her fingers. Now, though, she has more to do. She will not sleep tonight. Never again. She adjusts her sash and feels the pleasing weight of the clipboard in her satchel as she glides down the corridor toward the next door.
You are my work in the world,
she hears in her head as she walks with serene purpose down the corridor. It's the voice of God weaving golden through her mind like a bright banner flowing between the pillars of a church.
You are serving my purpose and paving my way.
I know, she says out loud. I love you.
are my voice.
Bring her to me.
She stops cutting and lowers her electric slicer and turns to him and stares. You have been thinking what? Thinking just... What if we are making a mistake? We are not making...
Okay, I deeply apologize. There has been a not atypical computer glitch. And we will bring you back approximately to the point that we were in the short story.
Mighty like a ram's horn, or hushed like the purposeful whisper of a child playing telephone, was now being heard.
Time is short.
And then, as the years went on, and the buildings slipped along on their various rates of decay, the messages began to vary. Some people hearing certain things and others hearing other things. Soon everyone heard, and soon the instructions became clear and specific, and nobody thought Jennifer Miller was crazy any longer, because everybody could hear. A man named Ronald Clark was the first to be told the day, and a woman named Barb Ruiz of Building 2 was given to know the method. Eventually, he let there be no ambiguity. He showed himself to be a democratic god and a clarion god. He let the word ring out and ring true to all. Here is my will, and here is how it shall be. It shall be by feast, by joyous gathering around tables of poison. These crumbling buildings we will leave behind, these frail bodies, and all of us will travel through together on the 1st of May of the appointed year. And now, at last, the day of the feast has come, and it will be in the morning.
P waits until her parents are gone. She sneaks silently up the stairs. She sits in her tiny room like she sat under the table in the kitchen, with her knees clasped to her chest and her body trembling, a frail flower. It's past midnight now. Just past. It's very dark outside. No stars. She has spent her whole life pretending, and at least that's almost over. She has learned to do the thing they do, tilt her head back and half-close her eyes, listening. Stop in the middle of a conversation and mouth silent words, as if in conversation with a ghost. Now it's all almost over. They live in Building 170. It is called that because it was the 170th one built of the original 200, but there are only 63 left now. P sits on her bed and looks out the window at the bleak black horizon, and her life is almost over. Her parents are good parents. They love her despite her deafness, but she knows it is a source of pain and shame to them. She knows one literally deaf child. That girl's name is Sharon. She is in the lower group, still 2 years behind P. She literally cannot hear. P can hear, but she can't hear God. P picks up her journal and then puts it down again. No point now, no sense. She has never written the truth in it. Too risky. She has hidden her secret her whole life without her parents ever telling her to, without needing to be told. Her whole life has been one ache, one absence. She lies down on the bed. Tomorrow it will all be over, one way or another. Sleep flickers in and out of her eyes. Dream scraps stitched together strangely. Her father riding on the Building 170 elevator, pointing the lever up. Her mother carving something that is not meat. She is awoken by a nervous plink, plink on the window. She sits upright and stares at the window. Her nightgown is gold-colored and old and ratty. There it is again. Plink, plink, like fingertips gently rapping on the glass. At last, she whispers. She slides off the bed, plink, plink, and walks on trembling legs toward the window. At last! What will he look like? How will he sound? Maybe there are special instructions that have been held back until now, because it was necessary that they be given to someone special. To her. Just to her. It was all a long test of her faith, and now it's done. She presses the buttons to work the window screen. She sees the puffy face distorted through the glass, and her excitement whooshes out of her. It's not God. It's Robert, a fat boy from her class. He is standing there sweating on the ledge that runs around the building, clinging to her sill. Poorly dressed, glasses skewed. His face confused and almost apologetic, as if he's not sure he's in the right place. He's wearing his clothes from the academy, though it is long after hours, though they will never need to be worn again. Robert must see it through the glass, the disappointment in P's face, and she immediately feels bad. She presses the buttons and opens the window, and Robert tumbles himself in over the sill and lands splat on her floor. P crosses her arms. She is in her thin gold nightgown. She's never talked much to boys in private. It's the middle of the night, the last night. She tucks her hair behind her ears and waits while he pulls his thick, clumsy body up to standing. "Hey," says Robert, obviously nervous, breathing loudly through his nose. "This is really strange," P says. "You being here." "I know," he says, nodding vigorously. "I know." And then he takes a deep breath and they peer at each other. His imperfections are striking. His eyes bulge behind thick lensed glasses. He's got odd hair, black tufts that go off in all directions like a scattered herd. P is afraid that he's never going to break the silence. Is he waiting for her to say something? But then... "P, you're different than other girls. Do you know? I mean different." "Oh," she says. "Oh, God." She feels a cold rush of fear. How does he know? How does he find out? Does he know? But then Robert suddenly starts talking again, 100 miles an hour, wringing his hands together and looking everywhere in the room except at her. I know this may seem crazy to bring this up to you now, but my heart has been with you since forever. I mean, not since forever, but for a long, long time. Since pubescence, and probably sooner, since academy." The words at first are a confusing blur, but then at once P understands, and her fear dissolves into embarrassment. For herself. For him. What Robert means when he says that she is different is that she is special. He means that he likes her. She cups her face with her hands. She almost laughs, but doesn't. He doesn't know her secret. He is confessing a crush. She looks up at him, holding her palm over her mouth. Of all the scenes to be playing out in her bedroom, late at night, late on this night. Honestly, Pete, I don't even know what I would want you to do with this information. Robert has his hands in his hair. He looks wildly about her room, his confusion accelerating. He is sweating so much. His neck, his chin, his forehead. P resolves to put him out of his misery. "I don't really like you in that way," she says suddenly, kind but firm, interrupting the heartsick monologue. "I'm sorry." Immediately Robert nods. Sure, I knew that was coming, obviously. I guess I was expecting that. I mean, of course, I knew that you would say that. He laughs nervously. P smiles at him. She feels bad for him, but she doesn't do anything like get up and take his hand or kiss him. She's not the kind of person to do something like that just because of the weird circumstances. But there is something nice about this, right now. She has never had a boyfriend, never kissed a boy. These are pleasant things to be thinking about, even in the negative, instead of what is coming, the morning, the meal, the end. And Robert, having unburdened himself, now seems almost relaxed. He takes the liberty of sitting down on P's bed and exhales and even laughs. "I expected that, like I said. I mean, it's funny, you know? It's kind of a little hilarious. If I can't get a girl to like me now, I guess it's just not in the cards, right?" He laughs again. He has a snorting kind of laugh. Now or never, right? I guess so, says P. But you know, pain will be a memory when we all go through. Pain will be a word in books. Right, he says. Of course. This is something people have heard. P, of course, has never heard it. She feels cold inside. She looks past Robert, out the window. He gets up, paces back and forth a couple more times, with his hands locked behind his back like a politician. Robert? I know, I'm leaving, he says. It's just... There's one more thing.
Bring her to me.
Annabelle sits in the dark in the basement of the building with her hands wrapped around herself, her fingers laced together, clutching her knees against her chest. For many years now, this has been her private place, down here in the storeroom of Building 170, among the scattered trophies from when things were good. This is where she comes to think, where she comes to wrestle with her burden. Not P, never P. P herself is not a burden, she's a joy. It is P's difference that is the burden. P's deafness. The question of what God wants for P, what Annabelle wants for her. Those are the burdens, and now the hour has come. Now it is almost here.
Bring her to me.
Annabelle winces and clutches her ears as if the voice can be silenced. For many years she has taken the service elevator down here when it is working, or taken the stairs otherwise. She comes down here and sits in the dim night glow to think, away from Kenneth, away from the others, away from the center. Sometimes it even feels like God's voice can't reach her here, as if this subterranean place is hidden from him, too buried for his voice to find her. Sometimes it feels like she is a little girl in the quiet world again, like when she was P's age, before Jennifer Miller. A time of pure, untroubled silence. Sometimes it feels that way, but not all the time. Not tonight.
Bring her to me.
So, Robert clears his throat and then lowers his voice. What are you doing tomorrow? What am I? P is confused. She steps back toward the bed. You're joking? No. Robert shakes his head. His hands are still clasped behind his back, and he is staring at the ground. No, I'm not joking, P. Is your family going through with it? Are you? P, still in her child's gold nightgown, gapes at him. He had been anxious before, nervous, like a child. Now it's as if Robert is growing up before her eyes, his agitation becoming more purposeful somehow, more adult. His hand worries at his hair. Everybody's going through with it, she tells him. He shrugs, makes a sour face. Is your family going through with it? She asks. Yes. Are you? He doesn't answer. She stares at him. She feels the valves of her heart open as if to allow an extra rush of blood. She pictures the kitchen counter two floors down, where the meat lays in curled piles, waiting, the bloody pink slices of tartare. When you were little, Robert asks her earnestly, did you ever peek out from between your fingers when the grace was being said? I don't know, says P. I don't remember. She does, though. She does remember. She would peek from between her fingers, just as Robert is saying, peek out and watch as her parents mouthed in silent communion with the God they could hear and she could not. She would sit, fearful and strange, staring at her food and waiting. Tomorrow night, says Robert, it's all I can think about. He rushes to her, then suddenly lifts her hands and holds them in his own. All I can think about is being here tomorrow night, being alive. What will it be like to still be alive tomorrow night? We could walk the streets between the buildings, P. We could do that. when everyone else is dead. It hits P like a wash of cool water, the absence of euphemism. Dead. They won't be dead. They will have gone through. They will be on the other side. Or maybe not. Maybe they'll just be dead. Oh, God, thinks P, where is your voice? Oh, God, guide me. Why would you want to stay in this world? She asks Robert quietly. This world has collapsed. This world is broken. Pah, says Robert. It's collapsed because everybody stopped taking care of it. It collapsed because everybody's been sitting around waiting to eat poison for 24 years. P stands there in a tense silence while time ticks by, and she feels thrilled and overwhelmed, disoriented and excited. She has thought these things before in the dark spaces that in other people's minds are filled by God's word. The buildings, those remaining, tilting toward each other in the marshes like old dominoes. The broken elevators. The aluminum fixtures that used to be steel. Everybody just waiting. The world slowly running down. P feels a butterfly fluttering around in the cold chamber of her chest. Its wings brush against the bars. She whispers to Robert, "You don't hear him either."
"Oh, I hear him," he says. He doesn't look like a fat, nervous kid anymore.
Dawn is approaching, and Marie St. Clair has finished her appointed rounds. Everybody in these three buildings knows. Everybody is ready. Everybody has been ready for years.
Go home now and wait.
She tightens her sash around her chest, her heart beating faster and faster as the sunrise approaches.
Go and be glad.
There is no question in her mind. That is perhaps the greatest thing. That is what makes her happy. No doubt and no question, no trouble and no worry. She simply knows what will happen next. The truth. The uncomplicated truth.
Bring her to me.
More.
Bring her to me.
I need to know more. Please. Please, I need to know more. Kenneth stands at the foot of the stairs in a furor of indecision. God will only say what he has said, what he keeps on saying, and his brevity is a kind of absence, the cruelest imaginable absence. Does it mean what his wife insists, that they must allow the child to die, like everyone, and that she will be brought through? Or does it mean, as Kenneth fears, that if he trusts God, he must trust him like Abraham? He must trust him all the way, report his own daughter's deafness, her defect, and abandon her. Allow her to be left behind so the process is not ruined for all the rest.
Bring her to me.
He knows what is right. Time is running out. Kenneth takes one deep breath and flings himself up the creaking stairs, three big steps at a time, as if over hurdles, as if slowing would make him stop. No, not as if. For he knows that indeed slowing down will make him stop. Kenneth hurls himself up the stairs and grabs the door handle of P's room and throws it open, and he meets his wife coming out of their daughter's room. Annabelle stares wildly at him. She is panting and shivering, and in her hand is the electric slicer, and it is on, humming, with red blood all along its vibrating edges. I am too late, Kenneth thinks. Too late, too late. Annabelle stares, the electric knife dancing in her palm, and at last her lips open and she says, "Where is she? What have you done with her? Where is she?"
"Bring her to me,"
says the voice in Kenneth's mind, and he can see it in the frozen mad look on her face, that she is hearing the same thing, the same, the same, the same.
"Bring her to me."
He rushes past her. They search the room. They lift the mattress and throw it aside. They toss open the dresser drawers and paw wildly through. They crowbar open the closet and find it empty. They feel the heat of time, of the morning sun growing closer, of the dawn of the new and final day. Kenneth and Annabelle rush to the window, and they look out and see nothing, and then they keep looking, and Annabelle sees it first, and then Kenneth does too, Or he thinks he does. Two distant shadows moving swiftly and getting smaller. Two shadows running so close beside each other they were almost one, slipping together into the narrow space between two towers, swallowed up by the buildings and disappearing into darkness.
Robert laughs as they run. He finds, indeed, that he cannot stop laughing. P is running beside him, and they are not holding hands, but every once in a while his right hand jostles against her left, and that mere touch, skin against skin, sends electric shivers coursing through his body. It isn't just that she's a girl. Not just that it's P. It's all of it. All of this wild, chaotic joy. The jolt of triumph and liberation, the thrill of rebellion, the sheer power of life continuing on. In the morning will be the feast for everyone but them. Light is beginning. The time is at hand. Robert looks at P, and he laughs, astonished, and she laughs back, astonished too. He watches her hair bounce on her back while they duck, giggling through the alleyways in search of what and where they do not yet know. The voice speaks then, freezing the smile on Robert's face, clouding his heart. It speaks in his mind, clear and cold, like a steel cage lowering.
Bring her to me. Bring her to me. Bring her to me.
Ben Winters is the winner of the Edgar Award for his novel, The Last Policeman, which was also an Amazon.com Best Book of 2012. Other works of fiction include the middle grade novel, The Secret Life of Miss Finkelman. An Edgar Award nominee, its sequel, The Mystery of the Missing Everything, the psychological thriller, Bedbugs, and two parody novels, Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters, a New York Times bestseller, and Android Karenina. Ben has also written extensively for the stage and is a past fellow of the Dramatist Guild. His journalism has appeared in Slate, The Nation, The Chicago Reader, and many other publications. He lives in Indianapolis, Indiana, and at benhwinters.com.
And you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. And that story by Ben Winters is but one of 23 in the anthology The End Is Nigh, edited by John Joseph Adams. And you can get a free copy of the entire audiobook. That was 1/22nd of it. The entire thing runs 15 hours and 8 minutes. And for a $50 donation to WBAI, you can get the entire 15 hours for free. As a thank you from WBAI and the editor, John Joseph Adams, for being a listener sponsor. The way to do that is by calling 212-209-2950. Again, 212-209-2950. This is, as they say, a limited time offer. So we're going to offer it again in 2 weeks. If all 10 have not gone, but if all 10 have gone, which I really have no way of knowing, then, well, you'll find out when you call, but make a donation anyway. 212-209-2950. We are almost out of time, but not quite. We have a 6.5 minute movie review from Dan Persons this week. So we're just going to go straight to it.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. So much to talk about with The Amazing Spider-Man 2. The film fails on so many levels that the 5 minutes or so that we have here is nowhere near adequate to cover its shortcomings. But you know what? We actually went quite into depth about the film over at our Cinefantastique Spotlight podcast, which became available on Monday. So I'm going to direct you over to cfqonline.com to check that out, And I'm going to go ahead and talk about a film more deserving of our attention, a dystopic little comedy called The Double. Let's consider the situation where a film's protagonist is presented as the ultimate victim. Usually, but not always, it's a comedy, and our putative hero or heroine, instead of rising to the challenges put his or her way, is instead overwhelmed by the situation, either through personal deficiencies or just because of the insurmountable nature of the circumstances. This is not always the easiest protagonist to bond with. Humans are blessed with power of empathy, but that goes only so far. The more a character demonstrates his powerlessness, the more primal instincts begin to kick in. In the jungle, that can lead to the alpha figure asserting his dominance, frequently violently. In the real world, in human society, well, we're better than that, aren't we? And we should try to hold on to that spirit of empathy regardless. As for a movie audience, it's only natural that if the demonstration of weakness goes on too long, at some point one is going to find oneself restraining the urge to shout at the screen, "Just freaking do something already." The better filmmakers know they have to short-circuit that urge. The Coen brothers can do it by escalating the victimization to such a level that it becomes a grand cosmic joke, as they did in A Serious Man, or style their protagonist so that we recognize that the storytellers understand at what point helplessness becomes personal failing, as with Inside Llewyn Davis. It also helps when you've got high-caliber actors such as Michael Stuhlbarg or Oscar Isaac as your leads. Terry Gilliam took both tacks in Brazil, creating a society whose bureaucracy was so grotesque that it was impossible to surmount, but also critiquing Jonathan Pryce's protagonist for his inability to shed his romantic fantasies in order to confront the real challenges facing him. There's more than a little Brazil in The Double, a new film directed by Richard Ayoade that's opening in limited release here in New York and also in L.A. this Friday, May 9th. It'll be available on demand then too, and it'll be available elsewhere in subsequent weeks. In a dystopic future, a put-upon bureaucrat, Simon James, played by Jesse Eisenberg, is fighting a losing war against becoming a complete non-entity. Not only has the security guard at his job stopped acknowledging his existence, while his boss, played by Wallace Shawn, has trouble remembering his name and members of the service industry flat out refuse to serve, but a new employee, James Simon, also played by Eisenberg, is his exact double. Except where Simon is timid and reserved, James is confident and charismatic. Where doors slam in Simon's face, they fling open for James. And since James has no compunction against advancing himself at the expense of his more reticent doppelganger, all the way to taking credit for work Simon has done and grabbing the attention of the woman played by Mia Wasikowska that Simon has long pined for, unless Simon does something to reverse the situation fast, he runs the risk of being completely subsumed by his ambitious double. The script by Avi Corin, who's Harmony Korine's brother, by the way, is based on a novella by Dostoevsky, with a bit of a sidetrack to Dumas's The Corsican Brothers to make things just a little more surreal. Director Ayoade locates the story in a stylized retro future, but instead of the quasi-30s, 40s technology Gilliam envisioned for Brazil, this world pushes more towards the 50s, with hulking industrial green cabinets for computer terminals and Xerox machines so immense they have their own time zones. By the way, those copiers have such large ventilation ducts attached to them that I'm presuming it's a deliberate nod to Brazil. What's interesting, though, is the effect that having the same actor play two sides of the same coin has on how the audience regards the put-upon protagonist. Even though we are supposed to be watching two separate people, the fact that we're looking at the same face informs our opinion of both characters, no matter which one we're watching. James's charisma extends our patience with the beaten-down Simon, while Simon's humanity keeps us from completely writing off James as a contemptible tool. It's a unique solution to the problem, helped considerably by Eisenberg's skill in playing both characters. Richard Ayoade made his feature film directorial debut with the non-genre comedy Submarine. Before then, he was best known here in the U.S. as the ultra-nerdy Maurice Moss on The It Crowd and as creator and co-star of the satirical horror series Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, as well as his involvement with the surreal British comedy show The Mighty Boosh. Sorry, it has to be pronounced that way. It's not just a good idea. It's the law. Anyway, there's a reflection of the latter two series' satirical formats in Ayoade's referencing of Brazil, but he manages to make the world of the double his own, and it's a world and a story that's at once very funny and dramatically engaging. The protagonist may be a failure in life, but the double is very much a victory as a film. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are now archiving these reviews over at Cinefantastique Online. Check out what you missed by going to cfqonline.com.
And thank you all for listening. This has been Our Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you, John Joseph Adams, for your time on the air and your donations. Thank those people who donated by calling 212-209-2950. And thank you for staying tuned to Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way over these airwaves in just a few minutes. I am apparently not on next week. I do not know what is. But I will be back in 2 weeks with writer Chris Claremont. Writer of what? Well, let's see. At Marvel Comics, yeah, for about 25 years or so, something called X-Men. So, you like that kind of stuff? Tune in. Again, thanks for listening. Have a great week. Be good to each other.
Crooks' mother. She just buried her last night. red, white, and blue. I'm not Captain America, too black, too strong, causing mass hysteria, trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works, jerk. My people, the people, all around the pig work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Born the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno, cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. To wake up to the lies, the pigs make up imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call it bits, cause I ain't taking. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison, cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs dribble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this shit. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx. Yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the Star Spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn wet Betty Ross soda. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
tanta injusticia? ¿Quiénes son culpables de tanta maldad? Todo el cruel fabricante de armas sangrientas, todo el guataca aliado al gran Babilonia. Pueblos que son explotados por los poderosos, niños descalzos que mueren sin pan, sin abrigo, hombres que pierden la tierra sin saber la razón, madres que lloran la ausencia de hijos perdidos. De aguas cristalinas, leones que comen la carne estando en el nido, hombres que ensayan cohetes en tierras sufridas, lacras ambiciosas de mal proceder. Hoy en la tierra molesta que piensa en la paz, hombres que pierden la vida por manos oscuras. Niños que están en la tierra sin nombre de padre,
sin nombre de padre.
Madres que lloran hijos cuando viene la muerte.
Cohetas de manos sangrientas, de oscuras miradas y falso reír.
Je ne peux pas m'imaginer que nous ne pouvons rien changer. C'est un combat pour vivre dans la justice et la dignité. Je ne peux pas m'imaginer que tout ne t'a jamais figé. Je veux vivre ma destinée en écartant la fatalité. Je me bats pour que les mots sortent de leur prison. C'est mon combat pour que les esprits retrouvent la raison. Car attention, attention, plus fort que la pression, plus on entend les explosions.
Carroza pretende dejar su marca. Oh, oh, oh. Oh, oh, oh. La coraza es de frío hierro como su corazón. Jamás se para a mirar. Todo lleva por delante. Todo lo que quiere es dejar su marca. Oh, oh, oh. Ni por su espada, por su espada. No, 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 no. Nunca me verá rendido. Oh, oh. El romano con su carroza pretende dejar su marca. Oh, oh, oh. Pero sus ruedas pararán, pues ya en mi pensamiento no. No, 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 no.
insultarse. Al juzgar una actitud, ¿cómo es esa?